see that. But the mask was silent, if that was, it had ever spoken at all. What are you going to do, Normie? That voice he knew, Dad's voice, a pain in the ass, but not scary. That other voice had been scary. Even if it had come out of his own throat, it had been scary.
Find her, he whispered. I'm going to find her, and then I'm going to teach her how to do the hanky-panky, my version of it.
Yes, but how? How are you going to find her? The first thought that came to him was their clubhouse on Durham Avenue. There'd be a record of where Rose was living there. He was sure of it, but it was a bad idea just the same. The place was a modified fortress. You'd need a key card of some sort, one that probably looked quite a lot like his stolen bank card, to get in, and maybe a set of numbers to keep the alarm system from going off as well. And what about the people there? Well, he could shoot the place up if it came to that, kill some of them and scare the rest off. His service revolver was back at the hotel in the room safe, one of the advantages of traveling by bus, but guns were usually an asshole solution. Suppose the address was in a computer. It probably was. Everyone used those pups these days. He'd very likely still be fucking around trying to get one of the women to give him the password and file name when the police showed up and killed his ass. Then something came to him, another voice. This one drifted up from his memory like a shape glimpsed in cigarette smoke. Sorry to miss the concert, but if I want that car, I can't pass up the... Whose voice was that, and what couldn't its owner afford to pass up? After a moment, the answer to the first question came to him. It was Blondie's voice, Blondie with the big eyes and the cute little ass, Blondie whose real name was Pam something. Pam worked at the Whitestone. Pam might well know his rambling Rose, and Pam couldn't afford to pass something up. What might that something be? When you really thought about it, when you put on that old deerstalker hat and put that brilliant detective's mind to work, the answer wasn't all that difficult, was it? When you wanted that car, the only thing you couldn't afford to pass up was a few extra hours at work. And since the concert she was passing up was this evening, the chances were good that she was at the hotel right now. Even if she wasn't, she would be soon. And if she knew, she would tell. The punk rock bitch hadn't, but that was only because he hadn't had time enough to discuss the matter with her. This time, though, he'd have all the time he needed. He would make sure of it.
Lieutenant Hale's partner, John Gustafson, drove Rosie and Gert Kinshaw to the District 3 police station in Lakeshore. Bill rode behind them on his Harley. Rosie kept turning in her seat to make sure he was still there. Gert noticed, but did not comment. Hale introduced Gustafson as my better half, but Hale was what Norman called the alpha dog. Rosie knew that from the moment she saw the two men together. It was in the way Gustafson looked at him, even in the way he watched Hale get into the shotgun seat of the unmarked Caprice. Rosie had seen these things for herself 1,000 times before, in her own home. They passed a bank clock, the same one Norman had passed not so long before, and Rosie bent her head to read the time, 4:09 p.m. The day had stretched out like warm taffy. She looked back over her shoulder, terrified that Bill might be gone, sure in some secret part of her heart and mind that he would be. He wasn't, though. He shot her a grin, lifted one hand and waved at her briefly. She raised her own hand in return.
"Seems like a nice guy," Gert said.
"Yes," Rosie agreed. But she didn't want to talk about Bill, not with the two cops in the front seat undoubtedly listening to every word they said. "You should have stayed at the hospital. Let them take a look at you, make sure he didn't hurt you with that taser thing."
"Shit, it was good for me," Gert said, grinning.
She was wearing a huge blue-and-white striped hospital bathrobe over her split jumper.
"First time I felt absolutely and completely awake since I lost my virginity at Baptist Youth Camp back in 1974.
Rosie tried for a matching grin and could manage only a wan smile. "I guess that's it for swing into summer, huh?" she said. Gert looked puzzled.
"What do you mean?"
Rosie looked down at her hands and was not quite surprised to see they were rolled into fists. "Norman's what I mean. A skunk at the picnic, one big fucking skunk." She heard that word, that fucking, come out of her mouth, and could hardly believe she'd said it.
especially in the back of a police car with a couple of detectives in the front seat. She was even more surprised when her fisted left hand shot out sideways and struck the door panel just above the window crank. Gustafson jumped a little behind the wheel. Hale looked back, face expressionless, then faced forward again. He might have murmured something to his partner. Rosie didn't know for sure, didn't care. Gert took her hand, which was throbbing, and tried to soothe the fist away, working on it like a masseuse working on a cramped muscle. "It's all right, Rosie." She spoke quietly, her voice rumbling like a big truck in neutral. "No, it's not," Rosie cried. "No, it's not. Don't you say it is." Tears were pricking her eyes now, but she didn't care about that either. For the first time in her adult life, she was weeping with rage rather than with shame or fear. "Why won't he go away? Why won't he leave me alone? He hurts Cynthia, he spoils the picnic. Fucking Norman." She tried to strike the door again, but Gert held her fist prisoner. "Fucking skunk Norman!" Gert was nodding. "Yeah, fucking skunk Norman. He's like a birthmark. The more you rub and try to get rid of it, the darker it gets. Fucking Norman. Fucking stinking crazy Norman. I hate him. I hate him." She fell silent, panting for breath. Her face was throbbing, her cheeks wet with tears. And yet, she didn't feel exactly bad. "Bill, where's Bill?" She turned, certain he would be gone this time, but he was there. He waved. She waved back. Then faced forward again, feeling a little calmer. "You be mad, Rosie. You got a goddamn right to be mad, but..." "Oh, I'm mad, all right. But he didn't spoil the day, you know." Rosie blinked. "What? But how could they just go on? After..." "How could you just go on? After all the times he beat you?" Rosie only shook her head, not comprehending. "Some of it's endurance," Gert said. "Some, I guess, is plain old stubbornness. But what it is mostly, Rosie, is showing the world your game face. Showing that we can't be intimidated. You think this is the first time something like this has happened? Uh-uh. Norman's the worst, but he's not the first. And what you do when a skunk shows up at the picnic and sprays around is you wait for the breeze to blow the worst of it away, and then you go on. That's what they're doing at Ettinger's Pier now, and not just because we signed a player-pay contract with the Indigo Girls, either. We go on because we have to convince ourselves that we can't be beaten out of our lives, our right to our lives. Oh, some of them will have left. Lana Klein and her patients are history, I imagine. But the rest will rally around. Consuela and Robin were heading back to Ettinger's as soon as we left the hospital." "Good for you guys," Lieutenant Hale said from the front seat. "How could you let him get away?" Rosie asked him accusingly. "Jesus, do you even know how he did it?" "Well, strictly speaking, we didn't let him get away," Hale said mildly. "It was Pier Security's baby. By the time the first Metro cops got there, your husband was long gone." "We think he stole some kid's mask," Gustafson said. "One of those whole head jobs. Put it on, then just boogied. He was lucky, I'll tell you that much." "He's always been lucky," Rose said bitterly. They were turning into the police station parking lot now, Bill still behind them. To Gert, she said, "You can let go of my hand now." Gert did, and Rosie immediately hit the door again. The hurt was worse this time, but some newly aware part of her relished that hurt. "Why won't he leave me alone?" she asked again, speaking to no one. And yet she was answered by a sweet, husky voice which spoke from deep in her mind. "You shall be divorced of him," that voice said. "You shall be divorced of him, Rosie Real." She looked down at her arms and saw that they had broken out all over in goose flesh.
His mind lifted off again, up, up, and away, as that foxy bitch Marilyn McCoo had once sung. And when he came back, he was easing the tempo into another parking space. He didn't know where he was for sure, but he thought it was probably the underground parking garage half a block down from the Whitestone, where he'd stowed the tempo before. He caught sight of the gas gauge as he leaned over to disconnect the ignition wires and saw something interesting. The needle was all the way over to F. He'd stopped for gas at some point during his last blank spot. Why had he done that? Because gas wasn't really what I wanted, he answered himself. He leaned forward again, meaning to look at himself in the rearview mirror, then remembered it was on the floor. He picked it up and looked at himself closely. His face was bruised, swelling in several places. It was pretty goddamn obvious that he'd been in a fight, but the blood was all gone. He had scrubbed it away in some gas station restroom while a self-serve pump filled the tempo's tank on slow automatic feed. So he was fit to be seen on the street, as long as he didn't press his luck, and that was good. As he disconnected the ignition wires, he wondered briefly what time it was. No way to tell. He wasn't wearing a watch. The shitbox tempo didn't have a clock, and he was underground. Did it matter? Did it? Nope, a familiar voice said softly. Doesn't matter. The time is out of joint. He looked down and saw the bull mask staring up at him from its place in the passenger side footwell. Empty eyes, disquieting wrinkled smile, absurd flower-decked horns. All at once he wanted it. It was stupid. He hated the garlands on the horns and hated the stupid, happy-to-be-castrated smile even more. But it was good luck, maybe. It didn't really talk, of course. All that was just in his mind. But without the mask, he certainly never would have gotten away from Edinger's Pier. That was for damn sure. Okay, okay, he thought. Viva Zibul. And he leaned over to get the mask. Then, with seemingly no pause at all, he was leaning forward and clamping his arms around Blondie's waist, squeezing her tight, tight, tight so she couldn't get enough breath to scream. She had just come out of a door marked housekeeping, pushing her cart in front of her, and he thought he'd probably been waiting out here for her for quite a while. But that didn't matter now, because they were going right back into housekeeping, just Pam and her new friend Norman, Viva Zibul. She was kicking at him, and some of the blows landed on his shins, but she was wearing sneakers and he hardly felt the hits. He let go of her waist with one hand, pulled the door closed behind him, and shot the bolt across. A quick look around, just to make sure the place was empty except for the two of them. Late Saturday afternoon, middle of the weekend, it should have been, and was. The room was long and narrow, with a short row of lockers standing at the far end. There was a wonderful smell, a fragrance of clean iron linen that made Norman think of laundry day at their house when he was a kid. There were big stacks of neatly folded sheets on pallets, Danduck's laundry baskets full of fluffy bath towels, pillowcases piled on shelves, deep stacks of coverlets lined one wall. Norman shoved Pam into these, watching with no interest at all as the skirt of her uniform flipped up high on her thighs. His sex drive had gone on vacation, perhaps even into permanent retirement, and maybe that was just as well. The plumbing between his legs had gotten him into a lot of trouble over the years. It was a hell of an oat, the sort of thing that might lead you to think that God had more in common with Andrew Dice Clay than you maybe wanted to believe. For 12 years you didn't notice it, and for the next 50, or even 60, it dragged you around behind it like some raving bald-headed Tasmanian devil. Don't scream, he said. Don't scream, Pammy. I'll kill you if you do. It was an empty threat, for now at least, but she wouldn't know that. Pam had drawn in a deep breath. Now she let it out in a soundless rush. Norman relaxed slightly. Please don't hurt me, she said, and boy, was that original. He'd certainly never heard that one before. Nope, nope. I don't want to hurt you, he said warmly. I certainly don't. Something was flopping in his back pocket. He felt for it and touched rubber, the mask. He wasn't exactly surprised. All you have to do is tell me what I want to know, Pam. Then you go on your happy way, and I go on mine. How do you know my name? He gave her that evocative interrogation room shrug, the one that said he knew lots of things. That was his job. She sat in the pile of tumbled dark maroon coverlets, just like the one on his bed up on the 9th floor, smoothing her skirt down over her knees. Her eyes were a really extraordinary shade of blue. A tear gathered on the lower lid of the left one, trembled, then slipped down her cheek, leaving a trail of mascara soot. "Are you going to rape me?" she asked. She was looking at him with those extraordinary baby blues of hers, great eyes. Who needs to pussy whip a man when you've got eyes like those, right, Pammy? But he didn't see the look in them he wanted to see. That was a look you saw in the interrogation room when a guy you'd been whipsawing with questions all day and half the night was finally getting ready to break. A humble look. A pleading look. A look that said, "I'll tell you anything, anything at all, just let off me a little." He didn't see that look in Pammy's eyes. Yet. "Pam, please don't rape me. Please don't. But if you do, if you have to, please wear a condom. I'm so scared of AIDS." He gawped at her, then burst out laughing. It hurt his stomach to laugh. It hurt his diaphragm even worse. And most of all, it hurt his face. But for a while, there was just no way he could stop. He told himself he had to stop, that some hotel employee, maybe even the house dick, might happen by and hear laughter coming from in here and wonder what it meant, but not even that helped. In the end, the throw had to pass on its own. Blondie watched him with amazement at first, then smiled tentatively herself, hopefully. Norman at last managed to get himself under control, although his eyes were streaming with tears by that time. "I'm not going to rape you, Pam," he said at last, when he was capable of saying anything without laughing it into insincerity. "How do you know my name?" she asked again. Her voice was a little stronger this time. He hauled the mask out, stuck his hand inside it, and manipulated it as he had for the asshole accountant in the Camry. "Pam, pam, bo, bam, banana, fana, fo, fam, fee, fi, mo, mam," he made it sing. He bopped it back and forth like Sherry Lewis with fucking lamb chop, only this was a bull, not a lamb, a stupid fucking fag bull with flowers on its horns. Not a reason in the world why he should like the fucking thing, but the fact was, he sort of did. "I sort of like you, too," Ferd the fag bull said, looking up at Norman with its empty eyes. Then it turned back to Pam, and with Norman to move its lips, it said, "You got a problem with that?" "No," she said, and the look he wanted still wasn't in her eyes. Not yet, but they were making progress. She was terrified of him, of them, that much was for sure. Norman squatted down, hands dangling between his thighs, Ferdinand's rubber horns now pointing at the floor. He looked at her sincerely. "Bet you'd like to see me out of this room and out of your life, wouldn't you, Pammy?" She nodded so vigorously her hair bounced up and down on her shoulders. "Yeah, I thought so, and that's fine by me. You tell me one thing and I'll be gone like a cool breeze. It's easy, too." He leaned forward toward her, Ferd's horns dragging on the floor. "All I want to know is where Rose is. Rose Daniels. Where does she live?" "Oh, my God." What color there still was in Pammy's face, two spots of red high up on her cheekbones, now disappeared, and her eyes widened until it seemed they must tumble from their sockets. "Oh, my God. You're him. You're Norman." That startled and angered him. He was supposed to know her name. That was how it worked. But she wasn't supposed to know his. And everything else followed upon that. She was up and off the coverlets while he was still reacting to his name in her mouth. And she almost got away completely. He sprang after her, reaching out with his right hand, the one that still had the bull mask on it. Faintly, he could hear himself saying that she wasn't going anywhere, that he wanted to talk to her and intended to do it right up close. He grabbed her around the throat. She gave a strangled cry that wanted to be a scream and lunged forward with surprising, sinewy strength. Still, he could have held her, if not for the mask. It slipped on his sweaty hand, and she tore away, fell away toward the door, arms out to either side, flailing, and at first Norman didn't understand what happened next. There was a noise, a meaty sound that was almost a pop like a champagne cork, and then Pam began to flail wildly, her hands beating at the door, her head back at a strained, stiff angle, like someone staring intently at the flag during a patriotic ceremony. "Huh?" Norman said, and Ferd rose up in front of his eyes, askew on his hand. Ferdinand looked drunk. "Oops," said the bull. Norman yanked the mask off his hand and stuffed it in his pocket, now aware of a pattering sound, like rain. He looked down and saw that Pam's left sneaker was no longer white. Now it was red. Blood was pooling around it. It ran down the door in long drips. Her hands were still fluttering. To Norman, they looked like small birds. She looked almost nailed to the door, and as Norman stepped forward, he saw that, in a way, she was. There was a coat hook on the back of the damn thing. She had torn free of his hand, plunged forward, and impaled herself. The coat hook was buried in her left eye. "Oh, Pam, shit, you fool," Norman said. He felt both furious and dismayed. He kept seeing the bull's stupid grin, kept hearing it say, "Oops," like some wise-ass character in a Warner Brothers cartoon. He yanked Pam off the coat hook. There was an unspeakable, gristly sound as she came. Her one good eye, bluer than ever, it seemed to Norman, stared at him in wordless horror. Then she opened her mouth and shrieked. Norman never thought about it. His hands acted on their own, grabbing her face by the cheeks, planting his big palms beneath the delicate angles of her jaw, and then twisting. There was a single sharp crack, the sound of someone stamping on a cedar shingle, and she went limp in his arms. She was gone, and whatever she had known about Rose was gone with her. "Oh, you dopey gal," Norman breathed. "Put your eye out on the fucking coat hook. How stupid is that?" He shook her in his arms. Her head flopped bonelessly from side to side. She now wore a wet red bib on the front of her white uniform. He carried Pam back over to the coverlets and dropped her there. She sprawled with her legs apart. "Brazen bitch," Norman said. "You can't even quit when you're dead, can you?" He crossed her legs. One of her arms dropped off her lap and thumped onto the coverlets. He saw a kinky purple bracelet around her wrist. It looked almost like a short length of telephone cord. On it was a key. Norman looked at this, then toward the lockers at the far end of the room. "You can't go there, Normie," his father said. "I know what you're thinking, but you're nuts if you go anywhere near their place on Durham Avenue." Norman smiled. "You're nuts if you go there. That was sort of funny when you thought about it. Besides, where else was there to go? What else was there to try? He didn't have much time. His bridges were burning merrily behind him. All of them." "The time is out of joint," Norman Daniels murmured and stripped the key bracelet off Pam's wrist. He went down to the lockers, holding the bracelet between his teeth long enough to stick the bull mask back on his hand. Then he held Ferd up and let him scan the dymotapes on the lockers. "This one," Ferd said, and tapped the locker marked Pam Haverford with his rubber face. The key fit the lock. Inside was a pair of jeans, a t-shirt, a sports bra, a shower bag, and Pam's purse. Norman took the purse over to one of the Danduck's baskets and spilled out the contents on the towels. He cruised Ferdinand over the stuff like some bizarre spy satellite. "There you go, big boy," Ferd murmured. Norman plucked a thin slice of gray plastic from the rubble of cosmetics, tissues, and papers. It would open the front door of their clubhouse, no doubt about that. He picked it up, started to turn away. "Wait," Zebul said. It went to Norman's ear and whispered, flower-decked horns bobbing. Norman listened, then nodded. He stripped the mask off his sweaty hand again, stuffed it back into his pocket, and bent over Pam's purse litter. He sifted carefully this time, much as he would have if he had been investigating what was called an event scene in the current jargon. Only then he would have used the tip of a pen or pencil instead of the tips of his fingers. "Fingerprints certainly aren't a problem here," he thought, and laughed. "Not anymore." He pushed her billfold aside and picked up a small red book with telephone address on the front. He looked under D, found an entry for daughters and sisters, but it wasn't what he was looking for. He turned to the front page of the book where a great many numbers had been written over and around Pam's doodles, eyes and cartoon bow ties mostly. The numbers all looked like phone numbers, though. He turned to the back page, the other likely spot. More phone numbers, more eyes, more bow ties, and in the middle, neatly boxed and marked with asterisks, this. 0471. "Oh boy," he said, "hold your cards, folks, but I think we have a bingo." "We do, don't we, Pammy?" Norman tore the back page out of Pam's book, stuffed it into his front pocket, and tiptoed back to the door. He listened. No one out there. He let out a breath and touched the corner of the paper he'd just stuck in his pocket. His mind lifted off in another of those skips as he did so, and for a little while there was nothing at all.
Hale and Gustafson led Rosie and Gert to a corner of the squad room that was almost like a conversation pit. The furniture was old but fairly comfortable, and there were no desks for the detectives to sit behind. They dropped instead onto a faded green sofa parked between the soft drink machine and the table with the bun-o-matic on it. Instead of a grim picture of drug addicts or AIDS victims, there was a travel agency poster of the Swiss Alps over the coffee maker. The detectives were calm and sympathetic. The interview was low-key and respectful, but neither their attitude nor the informal surroundings helped Rosie much. She was still angry, more furious than she had ever been in her life, but she was also terrified. It was being in this place. Several times as the Q&A went on, she came close to losing control of her emotions, and each time this happened, she would look across the room to where Bill was sitting patiently outside the waist-high railing, with its sign reading, "Police business only beyond this point, please." She knew she should get up, go over to him and tell him not to wait any longer, to just take himself on home and call her tomorrow. She couldn't bring herself to do it. She needed him to be there, the way she'd needed him to be behind her on the Harley when the detectives had been driving them here, needed him as an over-imaginative child needs a nightlight when she wakes up in the middle of the night. The thing was, she kept having crazy ideas. She knew they were crazy, but knowing didn't help. For a while they would go away, she would simply answer their questions and not have the crazy ideas, and then she would catch herself thinking that they had Norman down in the basement, that they were hiding him down there. Sure they were, because law enforcement was a family, cops were brothers, and cops' wives weren't allowed to run away and have lives of their own, no matter what. Norman was safely tucked away in some tiny sub-basement room where no one could hear you, even if you screamed at the top of your lungs. A room with sweaty concrete walls and a single bare bulb hanging down from a cord. And when this meaningless charade was over, they would take her to him. They would take her to Norman. Crazy. But she only fully knew it was crazy when she looked up and saw Bill on the other side of the low railing, watching her and waiting for her to be done so he could take her home on the back of his iron pony. They went over it and over it, sometimes Gustafson asking the questions, sometimes Hale, and while Rosie had no sense that the two men were playing good cop, bad cop, she wished they would finish with their interminable questions and their interminable forms and let them go. Maybe when she got out of there, those paralyzing swoops between rage and terror would abate a little. "Tell me again how you happened to have Mr. Daniels' picture in your purse, Miss Kinshaw," Gustafson said. He had a half-completed report in front of him and a Bic in one hand. He was frowning horribly. To Rosie, he looked like a kid taking a final exam he hasn't studied for. "I've told you twice already," Gert said. "This'll be the last time," Hale said quietly. Gert looked at him. "Scout's honor." Hale grinned, a very winning grin, and nodded. "Scout's honor." So she told them again how she and Anna had tentatively connected Norman Daniels to the murder of Peter Slowick, and how they had gotten Norman's picture by fax. From there, she went on to how she had noticed the man in the wheelchair when the ticket agent shouted at him. Rosie was familiar with the story now, but Gert's bravery still amazed her. When Gert got to the confrontation with Norman behind the comfort station, relating it in the matter-of-fact tones of a woman reciting a shopping list, Rosie took her big hand and squeezed it hard. When she finished this time, Gert looked at Hale and raised her eyebrows. "Okay." "Yes," said Hale. "Very okay. Cynthia Smith owes you her life. If you were a cop, I'd put you in for a citation." Gert snorted. "I'd never pass the physical. Too fat." "Just the same," Hale said, not smiling, meeting her eyes. "Well, I appreciate the compliment, but what I really want to hear from you is that you're going to catch the guy." "We'll catch him," Gustafson said. He sounded absolutely sure of himself, and Rosie thought, "You don't know my Norman, officer." "Are you done with us?" Gert asked. "With you, yes," Hale said.
I have a few more questions for Ms. McClendon. Can you deal with that? If not, they could wait. He paused. But they really shouldn't wait. I think we both know that, don't we? Rosie closed her eyes briefly, then opened them. She looked toward Bill, who was still sitting outside the railing, and then back at Hale. Ask what you have to, she said. Just finish as soon as you can. I want to go home.
This time, when he came back into his own head, he was getting out of the Temple on a quiet street he recognized almost at once as Durham Avenue. He was parked a block and a half down from the Pussy Palace. It wasn't dark yet, but getting there. The shadows under the trees were thick and velvety, somehow luscious. He looked down at himself and saw he must have gone to his room before leaving the hotel. His skin smelled of soap, and he was wearing different clothes. They were good clothes for this errand, too. Chinos, a white round-neck t-shirt, and a blue work shirt with the tails hanging out. He looked like the sort of guy who might turn out on a weekend to check a faulty gas connection or to check the burglar alarm, Norman said under his breath, and grinned. Pretty brazen, Signor Daniels. Pretty goddamn Panic struck like a thunderclap then, and he slapped at the left-hand rear pocket of the chinos he was now wearing. He felt nothing but the lump of his wallet. He slapped at the right-hand rear and let out a harsh sigh of relief as the limp rubber of the mask flopped against his hand. He had forgotten his service revolver, apparently, left it back in the room safe, but he'd remembered the mask, and right now the mask seemed a lot more important than the gun. Probably crazy, but there it was. He started up the sidewalk toward 251. If there were only a few cunts there, he'd try to take them all hostage. If there were a lot, he'd hold on to as many as he could, maybe half a dozen, and send the rest scampering for the hills. Then he'd simply start shooting them, one by one, until somebody coughed up Rose's address. If none of them knew it, he'd shoot them all and start checking files, but he didn't think it would come to that. What will you do if the cops are there, Normie? His father asked nervously. Cops out front, cops inside, cops protecting the place from you. He didn't know, and didn't much care. He passed 245, 247, 249. There was a hedge between that last one and the sidewalk, and as Norman reached the end of it, he stopped suddenly, looking at 251 Durham Avenue with narrow, suspicious eyes. He had been prepared to see a lot of activity or a little activity, but he had not been prepared for what he was seeing, which was no activity at all. Daughters and sisters stood at the end of its narrow, deep lawn with the second and third story shades pulled against the heat of the day. It was as silent as a relic. The windows to the left of the porch were unshaded but dark. There were no shapes moving in there, no one on the porch, no cars in the driveway. I can't just stand here, he thought, and got moving again. He walked past the place, looking into the vegetable garden where he'd seen the two whores before. One of them the whore he'd grabbed at the comfort station. The garden was also empty this evening, and from what he could see of the backyard, that was empty too. It's a trap, Normie, his father said. You know that, don't you? Norman walked as far as a Cape Cod with 257 on the door, then turned and began to saunter casually back down the sidewalk. He knew it looked like a trap. The father voice was right about that, but somehow it didn't feel like a trap. Ferdinand the Bull rose up before his eyes like a cheesy rubber ghost. Norman had pulled the mask out of his back pocket and put it on his hand without even realizing it. He knew this was a bad idea. Anyone looking out a window would be sure to wonder why the big man with the swollen face was talking to the rubber mask and making the mask answer back by wiggling its lips. Yet none of that seemed to matter either. Life had gotten very, well, basic. Norman sort of liked that. Nah, it's not a trap, Ferdinand said. Are you sure? He asked. He was almost in front of 251 again. Yeah, Ferdinand said, nodding his garlanded horns. They just went on with their picnic, that's all. Right now they're probably all sitting around toasting marshmallows while some dyke in a granny dress sings Blowin' in the Wind. You didn't amount to any more than a temporary wrinkle in their day. He stopped in front of the walk leading up to Daughters and Sisters, looking down at the mask, thunderstruck. Hey, sorry, guy, Zeebool said apologetically, but I don't make the news, you know. I only report it. Norman was stunned to discover there was something almost as bad as coming home to find out your wife had absconded for parts unknown with your bank card in her purse. There was being ignored by a bunch of women.
Well then, teach them not to do that, Ferd said. Teach them a lesson. Go on, Norm. Teach them who you are. Teach them so they'll never forget it.
So they'll never forget it, Norman muttered, and the mask nodded enthusiastically on his hand. He stuffed it into his back pocket again and pinched Pam's key card and the slip of paper he'd taken from her address book out of his left front one as he went up the walk. He climbed the porch steps, glancing up once, casually, he hoped, at the TV camera mounted over the door. He held the key card against his leg. Eyes might be watching, after all. He would do well to remember that, lucky or not, Ferdinand was only a rubber mask with Norman Daniels's hand for a brain. The keycard slot was just where he had expected it would be. There was a talk box beside it, complete with a little sign instructing visitors to press and speak. Norman pressed the button, leaned forward, and said, "Midland Gas, checking for a leak in the neighborhood, 10-4? He let go of the button, waited, glanced up at the camera. Black and white, probably wouldn't show how swollen his face was, he hoped. He smiled to show he was harmless as his heart pumped away in his chest like a small, vicious engine. No answer. Nothing. He pushed the button again. Anybody home, gals? He gave them time, counting slowly to 20. His father whispered that it was a trap, exactly the sort of trap he himself would have set in this situation, lure the scumbucket in, make him believe the place was empty, then land on him like a load of bricks. And yes, it was the kind of trap he himself would have set, but there was no one here. He was almost sure of it. The place felt as empty as a discarded beer can. Norman put the key card into the slot. There was a single loud click. He pulled the card out, turned the doorknob, and stepped into the front hall of daughters and sisters. From his left came a low, steady sound. Meep, 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 meep. It was a keypad burglar alarm. The words "front door" were flashing on and off in its message window. Norman looked at the slip of paper he'd brought with him. Took a second to pray the number on it was what he thought it was, and punched 0471. For one heart-stopping moment, the alarm continued to meep, and then it stopped. Norman let out his breath and closed the door. He reset the alarm without even thinking about it, just cop instinct at work. He looked around, noted the stairs going up to the second floor, then walked down the main hall. He poked his head into the first room on the right. It looked like a schoolroom, with chairs set up in a circle and a blackboard at one end. Written on the blackboard were the words, "Dignity, Responsibility, and Faith."
"Words of wisdom, Norm," Ferdinand said.
He was back on Norman's hand again. He'd gotten there like magic.
"Words of wisdom."
"If you say so, looks like the same old shit to me." He looked around, then raised his voice. It seemed almost sacrilegious to shout in this somehow dusty silence, but a man had to do what a man had to do. "Hello? Anybody here? Midland Gas? Hello?" Ferd shouted from the end of his arm, looking brightly around with his empty eyes. He spoke in the comic German voice Norman's father had sometimes used when he was drunk. "Hello? Was you there, Charlie?"
"Shut up, you idiot," Norman muttered.
"Yes, sir, Captain," Zebul replied, and fell silent at once.
Norman turned slowly around and then went on down the hall. There were other rooms along the way, a parlor, a dining room, what looked like a little library, but they were all empty. The kitchen at the end of the hall was empty, too, and now he had a new problem. Where did he go to find what he was looking for? He drew in a breath and closed his eyes, trying to think and trying to stave off the headache which was trying to come back. He wanted a cigarette, but didn't dare light one. For all he knew, they might have the smoke detectors turned up enough to shriek at the first whiff of tobacco. He drew in another deep breath, drew it all the way down to the floor of his lungs, and now recognized the smell in here for what it was. Not the smell of dust, but the smell of women. Women who had been long entrenched with their own kind. Women who had knitted themselves into a communal shroud of self-righteousness in an effort to block out the real world. It was a smell of blood and douche and sachet and hairspray and roll-on deodorant and perfumes with fuck-me names like My Sin and White Shoulders and Obsession. It was the vegetable smell of what they liked to eat and the fruity smell of the teas they liked to drink. The smell was not dust but something like yeast, a fermentation, and it produced a smell cleaning could never remove, the smell of women without men. All at once, that smell was filling his nose, filling his throat, filling his heart, gagging him, making him feel faint, almost suffocating him.
"Get hold of yourself, Charlie," Ferdinand said sharply. "All you smell is last night's spaghetti sauce. I mean, Jesus, please us."
Norman blew out a breath, took in another one, opened his eyes. Spaghetti sauce, yes, a red smell like blood, but spaghetti sauce was really all it was.
"Sorry, got a little flaky there for a minute," he said.
"Yup, but who wouldn't?" Ferd said, and now his empty eyes seemed to express both sympathy and understanding. This is where Circe turns men into pigs, after all. The mask swiveled on Norman's wrist, scanning with its blank eyes.
"Yes, this be the place."
"What are you talking about?"
"Nothing. Never mind."
"I don't know where to go," Norman said, also looking around. "I've got to hurry, but Christ, the place is so big. There must be 20 rooms at least."
The bull pointed its horns at a door across the kitchen.
"Try that one."
"Hell, that's probably just the pantry."
"I don't think so, Norm. I don't think they'd put a sign that says private on the pantry. Do you?"
It was a point. Norman crossed the room, stuffing the bull mask back into his pocket as he did, and noticing the spaghetti colander which had been left to drip dry in the rack beside the sink, then rapped on the door. Nothing. He tried the knob. It turned easily. He opened the door, felt inside on the right, and flipped a switch. The overhead fixture illuminated a dinosaur of a desk heaped high with clutter. Balanced atop one pile was a gold plaque which read, "Anna Stevenson, and bless this mess." On the wall was a framed picture of two women Norman recognized. One was the late, great Susan Day. The other was the white-haired bitch from the newspaper photo, the one who looked like Maud. They had their arms around each other and were smiling into each other's eyes like true lesbos. The side of the room was lined with filing cabinets. Norman walked over to them, dropped to one knee, started to reach for the cabinet labeled D.E., then stopped. She wasn't using Daniels anymore. He couldn't remember if that was something Ferdinand had told him or something he'd either found out or intuited for himself, but he knew it was true. She had gone back to her maiden name.
"You'll be Rose Daniels until the day you die," he said, and reached for the M cabinet instead. He tugged. Nothing. It was locked.
A problem, but not a big one. He'd get something in the kitchen to pry it open with. He turned, meaning to go back out, then stopped, his eye caught by a wicker basket standing on the corner of the desk. There was a card hanging from the basket's handle. "Go then, little letter," was written on it in old English script. There was a small stack of what looked like outgoing mail in the basket, and below a bill payer envelope addressed to Lakeland Cable TV, he saw this poking out.
"Endon, Renton Street."
"Endon? McClendon?" He snatched the letter up, overturning the basket and dumping most of the outgoing mail on the floor, his eyes wide and greedy.
"Yes, McClendon, by God, Rosie McClendon," and right below it, firmly and legibly printed, the address he'd gone through hell to get, 897 Trenton Street.
There was a long, chrome-plated letter opener lying half under a stack of leftover swing-into-summer flyers. Norman grabbed it, slit the letter open, and shoved the opener into his back pocket without even thinking about it. He pulled out the mask again at the same time and slid it onto his hand. The single sheet of paper bore an embossed letterhead which read Anna Stevenson in big letters and daughters and sisters in slightly smaller ones. Norman gave this small ego signal a quick glance, then began to cruise the mask over the paper, letting Ferdinand read it for him. Anna Stevenson's handwritten script was large and elegant, arrogant, some might have termed it. Norman's sweaty fingers shook and tried to clench inside Ferdinand's head, sending the rubber mask through a series of convulsive winces and leers as it moved. "Dear Rosie, I just wanted to send you a note in your new digs. I know how important those first few letters can be. Telling you how glad I am that you came to us at Daughters and Sisters, and how glad I am we could help you. I also want to say how pleased I am with your new job. I have an idea you won't be living on Trenton Street for long. Every woman who comes to Daughters and Sisters renews the lives of all the others, those there with her during her first period of healing, and all those who come after she's left, for each one leaves a bit of her experience, strength, and hope behind. My hope is to see you here often, Rosie, not just because your recovery is a long way from complete and because you have many feelings, chiefly anger, I should surmise, which you haven't dealt with yet, but because you have an obligation to pass on what you've learned here. I probably don't need to tell you these things, but... A click. Not much of a sound, but loud in the silence. This was followed by another sound. Meep, 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 meep. The burglar alarm. Norman had company.
Anna never noticed the green Tempo parked by the curb a block and a half down from Daughters and Sisters. She was deep in a private fantasy, one she had never told anyone, not even her therapist. The necessary fantasy she saved for horrible days like today. In it, she was on the cover of Time magazine. It wasn't a photo, but a vibrant oil painting which showed her in a dark blue shift. Blue was her best color, and a shift would obscure the depressing way she had been thickening around the middle these last 2 or 3 years. She was looking over her left shoulder, giving the artist her good side to work with, and her hair spilled over her right shoulder in a snowdrift. A sexy snowdrift. The caption beneath the picture read simply, American Woman. She turned into the driveway, reluctantly putting the fantasy away. She had just reached the point where the writer was saying, although she has reclaimed the lives of over 1,500 battered women, Anna Stevenson remains surprisingly, even touchingly, modest. She turned off the engine of her Infiniti and just sat there for a moment, delicately rubbing at the skin beneath her eyes. Peter Slowick, whom she had usually referred to at the time of their divorce as either Peter the Great or Rasputin the Mad Marxist, had been a promiscuous babbler when alive, and his friends had seemed determined to remember him in that same spirit. The talk had gone on and on, each remembrance bouquet. She thought that she could cheerfully machine gun the politically correct buttholes who spent their days thinking such smarmy phrases up. Seemingly longer than the last, and by 4 o'clock, when they had finally gotten up to eat the food and drink the wine, domestic and dreadful, just what Peter would have picked if he'd been the one doing the shopping, she was sure the shape of the folding chair on which she'd been sitting must have been tattooed into her ass. The idea of leaving early, perhaps slipping out after one finger sandwich and a token sip of wine, had never crossed her mind, however. People would be watching, evaluating her behavior. She was Anna Stevenson, after all, an important woman in the political structure of this town, and there were certain people she had to speak to after the formal ceremonies were over, people she wanted other people to see her talking to, because that was how the carousel turned. And, just to add to the fun, her pager had gone off 3 times in a space of 45 minutes. Weeks went by when it sat mutely in her purse. But this afternoon, during a meeting where there were long periods of silence broken by people who seemed incapable of speaking above a tearful mutter, the gadget had gone crazy. After the 3rd time, she got tired of the swiveling heads and turned the Christing thing off. She hoped nobody had gone into labor at the picnic, that nobody's kid had taken a thrown horseshoe in the head, and most of all, she hoped Rosie's husband hadn't shown up. She doubted that he had, though. He would know better. In any case, anyone who'd call her pager would have called DNS first, and she'd make the answering machine in her study stop number 1. She could listen to the messages while she peed. In most cases, that would be fitting. She got out of the car, locked it, even in a good neighborhood like this you couldn't be too careful, and went up the porch steps. She used her key card and silenced the meep, meep, meep of the security system without even thinking of it. Sweet shreds of her daydream, only woman of her time to be loved and respected by all factions of the increasingly divergent women's movement, still swirled in her head. "Hello, the house," she called, walking down the hall. Silence replied, which was what she'd expected and, let's face it, hoped for. With any luck, she might have 2 or even 3 hours of blessed silence before the commencement of that night's giggling, hissing showers, slamming doors, and cackling sitcoms. She walked into the kitchen, wondering if maybe a long, leisurely bath, Calgon and all, wouldn't smooth off the worst of the day. Then she stopped, frowning across at her study door. It was standing ajar. God damn it, she muttered. God damn it. If there was one thing she disliked above all others, except maybe for touchy-huggy-feely people, it was having her privacy invaded. She had no lock on her study door because she did not believe she should be reduced to that. This was her place, after all. The girls and women who came here came through her generosity and at her sufferance. She shouldn't need a lock on that door. Her desire that they should stay out unless invited in ought to have been enough. Mostly it was, but every now and then some woman would decide she really needed some piece of her documentation, that she really needed to use Anna's photocopier, which warmed up faster than the one downstairs in the rec room, that she really needed a stamp. And so this disrespectful person would come in. She'd track through a place that wasn't hers, maybe look at things that weren't hers to look at, junk up the air with the smell of some cheap drugstore perfume. Anna paused with one hand on the study doorknob, looking into the dark room, which had been a pantry when she was a little girl. Her nostrils flared slightly, and the frown on her face deepened. There was a smell, all right, but it wasn't quite perfume. It was something that reminded her of the mad Marxist. It was, all my men wear English leather, or they wear nothing at all. Jesus! Jesus Christ! Her arms crawled with goose flesh. She was a woman who prided herself on her practicality, but suddenly it was all too easy to imagine Peter Slowick's ghost waiting for her inside her study, a shade as insubstantial as the stink of that ludicrous cologne he'd worn. Her eyes fixed on a light in the darkness, the answering machine. The little red lamp was stuttering madly, as if everyone in the city had called today. Something had happened. All at once, she knew it. It explained the pager, too, and like a dummy, she'd turned it off so people would stop staring at her. Something had happened, probably at Ettinger's Pier. Someone hurt, or, God forbid. She stepped into the office, feeling for the light switch beside the door, then stopped, puzzled by what her fingers had found. The switch was already up, which meant the overhead light should be on, but it wasn't. Anna flipped the switch up and down twice, started to do it a third time, and then a hand dropped on her right shoulder. She screamed at that settling touch, the sound coming out of her throat as full and frantic as any scream ever voiced by a horror movie heroine, and as another hand clamped on her upper left arm and turned her around on her heels, as she saw the shape silhouetted against the flooding light from the kitchen, she screamed again. The thing which had been standing behind the door and waiting for her wasn't human. Horns sprouted from the top of its head, horns which appeared to be swollen with strange tumorous growths. It was, "Viva Zibul," a hollow voice said, and she realized it was a man wearing a mask, but that didn't make her feel any better because she had a very good idea of who the man was. She tore out of his grip and backed toward the desk. She could still smell English leather, but she could smell other things now as well, hot rubber, sweat, and urine. Was it hers? Had she wet herself? She didn't know. She was numb from the waist down. "Don't touch me," she said in a trembling voice utterly unlike her usual calm and authoritative one. She reached behind her and felt for the button that summoned the police. It was there someplace, but buried under drifts of paper. "Don't you dare touch me. I'm warning you." "Anna, Anna, Bobana, Banana, Fana, Fopana," the creature in the horned mask said in a tone of deep meditation, and then swept the door shut behind it. Now they were in total darkness. "Stay away," she said, moving along the desk, sliding along the desk. If she could get into the bathroom, lock the door. "Fee, fi, mo, mena," from her left, and close. She lunged to the right, but not soon enough. Strong arms enfolded her. She tried to scream again, but the arms tightened, and her breath came out in a silent rush. "If I were Misery Chastain, I'd," she thought, and then Norman's teeth were on her throat. He was nuzzling her like a horny kid parked on Lover's Lane, and then his teeth were in her throat, and something was spraying warm all down the front of her, and she thought no more. By the time the final questions were asked and the final statement was signed, it was long past dark. Rosie's head spun, and she felt a little unreal to herself, as she had after those occasional all-day tests they threw at you in high school. Gustafson went off to file his paperwork, bearing it before him as if it were the Holy Grail, and Rosie got to her feet. She began moving toward Bill, who was also getting up. Gert had gone in search of the ladies' room. "Ms. McClendon?" Hale asked from her elbow. Rosie's weariness was supplanted by a sudden, horrid premonition. It was just the two of them. Bill was too far away to overhear anything Hale might say to her, and when he began to speak, he would do so in a low, confidential voice. He would tell her that she would stop all this foolishness about her husband right now, while there was still time, if she knew what was good for her. That she would keep her mouth shut around cops from here on out unless one of them either A, asked her a question, or B, unzipped his fly. He would remind her that this was a family thing, that... "I am going to bust him," Hale said mildly. "I don't know if I can completely convince you of that, no matter what I say, but I need you to hear me say it anyway. I am going to bust him. It's a promise." She looked at him with her mouth open. "I'm going to do it because he's a murderer and crazy and dangerous. I'm also going to do it because I don't like the way you look around the squad room and jump every time a door slams somewhere, or the way you cringe a little every time I move one of my hands. I don't, you do. You can't help it, and you do. That's all right, though, because I understand why you do. If I was a woman, and I'd been through what you've been through..." He trailed off, looking at her quizzically. "Has it ever occurred to you how magic goddamn lucky you are just to be alive?" "Yes," Rosie said. Her legs were trembling. Bill was standing at the gate, looking at her, clearly concerned. She forced a smile for him and raised a single finger. "One more minute." "You bet you are," Hale said. He glanced around the squad room, and Rosie followed his eyes. At one desk, a cop was writing up a weeping teenager in a high school letter jacket. At another, this one by the chicken-wired floor-to-ceiling windows, a uniformed cop and a detective with his jacket off so you could see the 38 police special clipped to his belt were examining a stack of photos, their heads close together. At a row of VDT screens all the way across the room, Gustafson was discussing his reports with a young blue suit who looked no older than 16 to Rosie. "You know a lot about cops," Hale said, "but most of what you know is wrong." She didn't know how to answer that, but it was okay. He didn't seem to require an answer. "You want to know what my biggest motivation for busting him is, Ms. McClendon? Numero uno on the old hit parade?" She nodded. "I'm going to bust him because he's a cop. A hero cop, for God's sake. But the next time his puss is on the front page of the old hometown paper, he's either going to be the late Norman Daniels, or he's going to be in leg irons and an orange tracksuit." "Thank you for saying that," Rosie said. "It means a lot." He led her over to Bill, who opened the gate and put his arms around her. She hugged him tight, her eyes shut. Hale asked, "Ms. McClendon?" She opened her eyes, saw Gert come back into the room and waved. Then she looked at Hale shyly, but not fearfully. "You can call me Rosie, if you want." He smiled briefly at that. "Would you like to hear something that'll maybe make you feel a little better about your first less-than-enthusiastic reaction to this place?"
I guess so."
"Let me guess," Bill said. "You're having problems with the cops back in Rosie's hometown." Hale smiled sourly. "Indeed we are. They're being shy about faxing us what they know about Daniel's blood medicals, even his prints. We're already dealing with police lawyers, cop shysters."
"They're protecting him," Rosie said. "I knew they would."
"So far, yes, it's an instinct, like the one that tells you to drop everything and go after the killer when a cop gets gunned down. They'll stop trying to throw sand in the gears when they finally get it through their heads that this is real."
"Do you really believe that?" Gert asked.
He thought this over, then nodded.
Yes, I do.
What about police protection for Rosie until this is over?